Hi, I'm Mary Jane.
And I'm Bridget, and we'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Super Good Juice podcast.
The Super Good Juice podcast is a place where we talk to incredible women about their careers.
We know that careers aren't linear, but nobody really talks about it.
And so this is a space to share and listen and hopefully learn something along the way.
Thanks for joining us. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to this, our fourth episode of the Super Good Juice podcast. Today, Bridge and I are joined by Katie Duncan, a mother, ex-journalist, business owner, survivor, and all-round good person. This episode was a special one for me. I've known Katie and her family my entire life. I'm pretty sure she told me how babies were made. Anyway, today we talked to her about her career in journalism, working for and then taking the reins of her family's catering company with her business partner Michelle, expanding their service offering into the aged care space, and how she deals with a constant internal calling to feed all the children of Aotearoa. She also talks candidly about the past decade plus as they lived with and navigated the Christchurch earthquake and its aftermath, confronting the loss of her beloved father Grant, having babies, the Christchurch mosque shooting, and most recently COVID. Hers is a story of resilience, though she's rightly sick of hearing that, a deep commitment to people, an unwavering passion for what is right, and so much more. We hope you enjoy this episode as much as we enjoyed speaking with Katie. Enjoy.
Katie, obviously we've met once and I absolutely fell in love with you and your mother, but I particularly fell in love with you. And I'm super curious to hear how your story has evolved. Where did you start and where are you at now? Let us know your background.
Where did I start and where am I now? Well, once I figure that out, I might let you know. I guess maybe things like this are a very good way of figuring out who you are, where you've been, what you stand for, and where you're going. I am a caterer in Christchurch, and I have been in and out of the business that I currently own with a business partner. My parents owned it before me, and I worked for the founder before my parents bought it. So it's a business that I've been in and out of for about 28 years. But in the middle of it all, when I was at the end of high school, I went to university, obviously. Well, I went to the New Zealand Broadcasting School and did a degree in journalism, broadcasting journalism, and then spent a few years doing journalism and being a journalist and working in radio and ending up in the press gallery at a reasonably young age. And then I think I ended up having just a little bit of difficulty as an impartial observer, which journalists are so often required to be. And impartiality is not my strong suit. And I found working so hard to be impartial actually kind of came out almost like a form of anxiety. Like it was so stifling to not say to political talking heads what I actually thought about what they had to say. And it kind of somehow manifested like some form of anxiety, and I really struggled for a time working in broadcasting and having that relationship with the news. I remember very early on my news director saying to me, you're going to have to figure out how to deal with this, otherwise you're going to go mad in 6 years if you don't learn to not be so emotionally invested in the news and content of the news, you know, like being so affected by the stories that you were working on. And he said, if you can't detach from it, you're going to send yourself mad. And I essentially did that almost in a way. And so then when I decided to have some time away from the news and wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, I ended up back at this catering company, White Tie in Christchurch, owned by my parents. And then it's been, I don't know what you guys talk about necessarily with other interviewees and people who might have had great ideas, strategies, tools, mechanisms to deal with life and find their way through. But I have found in the last 10 years of it's been an exercise in resilience and constantly redefining my business, my role in it, and now we're 2022 And we've been operating a hospitality business in Christchurch for a very long time, which has for many reasons been a tumultuous hospitality ground, earthquakes, mosque attacks, COVID, all those kind of things. And so now I'm at a point where I have a catering company at the end of, hopefully the tail end of all the restrictions of COVID. And I'm not really sure what's next, who I am, where I'm going. Could tell you.
When you did say for 10 years it's been an act of resilience, I thought, okay, 2 years, COVID, yep. What happened before then? And I thought, as you said it, all of those huge events just tumbled into my mind. And that resilience must have just been tested so often. Were there moments where you're like, why am I doing this?
There are so many moments of why am I doing this? And I think we got to a point in Christchurch when people saying things like, oh, you're so resilient, or kia kaha Christchurch, we were so sick of it. We resented it. We didn't want to have to be resilient. I wasn't interested in being resilient. We weren't resilient because we were good at being resilient. It was literally because we had no choice. And I think the earthquakes nearly destroyed our business. And then a few years after that, my father passed away, which is the most significant event in my life. And that was horrific. And that was just on top of a lot of stuff that had already happened. And then after that, we had the mosque attacks in Christchurch, which was a devastating experience for Christchurch as a community and for New Zealand as a whole, but Christchurch as a community, because we'd already been through so much. But I think part of that was that we also knew how to come together. If you look at the global responses to these kind of events and how Christchurch shifted that, and how there were thousands and thousands and thousands of people in Hagley Park on a Friday afternoon, the following week, and how we haven't seen those responses elsewhere in the world. Christchurch as a community already knew how to come together. So, and then we had COVID. And I just think that as a place and as a time, the last 10 years in Christchurch, New Zealand has been an incredibly difficult place to be and a very difficult place to be a business owner.
God, I can't even imagine it. So what was it then that compelled you to push through and work through that resilience? Because for a lot of people, they would have just said, see you later. I've done as much as I can. I need to protect myself and my family, and this isn't helping. What was the motivation to keep pushing through?
It was responsibility to other people. Mm. When you own a business and you have employees, your decisions are no longer just yours. The decisions that you make have very real ramifications on your employees. And when COVID started, we had a number of sites around New Zealand that we were running in-house kitchens for a client. So we had 120 employees. And to have made any decisions around our viability at that time would have had long-lasting ramifications for reasonably vulnerable workers as well. You are talking about hospitality workers, aged care workers. They're a reasonably vulnerable group of employees. They are low-skilled-ish, some highly skilled, but there's a lot of low skill. There's not a lot more than minimum wage roles going on in a lot of those, you know, dishwashing, delivering meals off a trolley, those kind of roles, but they're also incredibly vulnerable employees. So for us, a lot of those employees were working multiple jobs or multi-generational living, overcrowded issues. They didn't have access to great support or even an understanding of the support that was available to them. And so the decisions that we made, my business partner, Michelle, and I, as two female business owners, was that we have such a duty of care here. And that's kind of what drove every decision that we made.
We were able to keep all of your staff employed over the whole COVID period?
Mostly.
Wow.
Mostly we were. Yeah. And a lot of that had to do with government wage subsidies. And it had a lot to do with the part of our business that was in aged care. So we weren't as vulnerable as the other part of our business, which was events and catering and corporate and things like that. And aged care was obviously essential, but we did manage to, for the most part, keep nearly everybody for the 2 year period, but it was at great cost to other parts of the business. very much felt like the right thing to do.
What parts of the business may have not suffered, but
I think probably where we made decisions to keep staff, where we might have been able to diversify some of our income to somewhere else in the business. We might have also, in reality, we might have also been able to give pay rises if we had fewer staff, just a few things like that. But it just didn't feel like the right thing to do. And I think that we, you know what, if I look back on it now, there's every chance that our decisions would have been different if we hadn't already been through the earthquakes.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So is that because you already had quite an affected workforce and you felt?
I think it's more that we backed our ability to navigate the business through a crisis. Mm. Yeah.
Got you done my it business once. Partner and
I, yeah. My business partner and I often joke that we're not caterers, we're crisis managers. We're basically Olivia Pope without the violence. You know, if we ever walked away from catering and sold our business and went somewhere else, we think that we'd just be professional crisis managers because that's really what it feels like we've spent the last 10 years doing.
I'm really interested to hear, because obviously White Tie Catering hasn't always had the aged care part to the business there. How did that become part of the strategy? Because it obviously was really important in the last couple of years to have that revenue stream. How did that strategy come about, and thank goodness you had it, or how's it feeling at the moment?
Yeah, it was an outstanding piece of diversification pre-COVID, where we had no idea how important it was going to be. So we have a private hospital here in Christchurch, and we then started working with an aged care provider. When they opened their first village in Christchurch, they wanted to trial something different. And off the back of that, we learnt about what we could bring to aged care. Because all of us have had experiences where we're really unhappy with the kind of food that our relatives have been fed in aged care. We'd started going into some villages on site visits, and it was just so wrong what was being served as a viable meal that had apparently been ticked off by a dietitian in aged care. And so we grew that piece of business because we were quite passionate about it. We actually saw that we had the skills and the expertise to make a significant difference in that sector without being more expensive in that sector. So we could take the same money, the same budget that they were using for their residents, and we could achieve something quite different. And we became quite passionate about that, and I still very much am. And so growing into that piece was hugely critical for our COVID survival, but now is one of the pieces of business that gives me so much pleasure and that I work on a lot, is because it's very tangible, changing the lives of aged care residents just through food that's on the plate. And I mean, Bridget, I know that you saw me at Ruth Pretty doing a cooking class, and I get on my soapbox about it. I get quite passionate and upset. And I go into an aged care and the first thing I do is throw out all the scoops that they use to dish up mashed potato. Because if you don't do that at home, why are you doing it in these residents' home? Why does it need to look like hospital food for a start? Mm-hmm. Who uses an ice cream scoop to dish up potatoes?
That's so weird.
Why would you start doing it? Why would you make food look so uniform,
unappealing,
and you know? So
institutionalized.
Institutionalized, and we realized the impact that we could actually have for our clients, and our clients being the village companies, but also the residents. We discovered incredibly tangible benefits to the residents by us moving into a site. And so then, in a way, it almost has a philanthropic bent for me doing the aged care work.
Which fits beautifully.
Yeah, you're setting a standard, essentially. It's really annoying to hear that for the same amount of money, a bit of love, care, and effort can just have such different results. Because I think of my nana, who's in Bupa in Hamilton, and I think of my gran, it's her fifth year anniversary of passing away today. Makes me so angry that with the same money, if it's not a cost-saving thing, what the hell is it?
It's not a cost-saving thing. It's a lack of understanding. And so there's a lot of packet opening. There's a lot of powdered product, whereas we go in with a model that says you turn over your stock every 48 hours.
Right.
You're not holding containers of prepped goods on the shelf. Mm. You're starting with raw and you're cooking with love from scratch. And that's honestly the secret to it. It's half of the recipes that we use were my nana's. And that was about very smart cooking in the 40s and 50s. But that also appeals to our residents because it's familiar. It's not intimidating. But I mean, food is my area of expertise. So my relationship with food might be different to other people's, but I've always been very attached to food. But I'm not alone in that it provides a lot of comfort and nostalgia. And I think for us, when we go into aged care, it's about giving it's really about giving dignity.
Mm.
You know, we're getting rid of lasagna toppers, you know, which is what we saw all the time. We saw that all the time,
wild,
a plate,
man,
with a lasagna topper on it. And that's what's being served for dinner in aged care. It's just totally inappropriate. And actually sending them into their graves much sooner, you're creating all sorts of other problems by not having that level of nourishment in their diets. So, yeah, I get a real bee in my bonnet about it.
Can you explain what a lasagna topper is for our overseas listeners? Because I think it's quite a Kiwi thing.
It's sodium crack, basically. So it's a piece of lasagna that is then crumbed and deep fried. So it's basically salt and carbohydrate with some more salt and then some fat.
Why not just make a lasagna?
Just make a lasagna. It would be cheaper than buying literally cheaper than buying everybody a lasagna topper. It's just madness what goes on. But
more delicious.
I'm delving too much into nuance, but you can see that it really affects me. In New Zealand, 9 out of 10 of our residents who arrive in a care centre, so they arrive to a care centre, 9 out of 10 of them are malnourished. 90% of our aged care population still living in the community is malnourished. And for me, we have an Indigenous population that models intergenerational aged care and how age actually creates mana and comes with a certain level of respect. And in our Pākehā community, we've not learned from that at all. And yet what we could be achieving with an aging population crisis, just do it properly.
Katie, do you guys consult in this space, or do you have a bit of a wider net to throw?
So what we've done as a result of it is created a consultancy piece where we go in and we provide menus, recipe training, capacity building for staff, and then we walk away and leave them to it. Traditionally, there's two models. One is that a provider works in-house, so they run their own kitchen. And the other option is that you use an off-site provider who runs your kitchen for you. And neither of them particularly solve all of the issues. And so by taking in the menus and recipes, we use our expertise and the expertise of our recipe development team to create these menus and recipes for aged care. Whereas our recipe developing team, our chefs, our staff would probably not be interested in working in aged care. They're very passionate about food exploration technique, the science of food, things like that. So they might not get their kicks working in aged care kitchen, but you actually need that level of understanding and expertise to create great recipes for those budgets. So that's why it works. We can use white tie to kind of cross that bridge.
Fantastic.
Mm.
And what about the teams who are in the kitchens? I imagine that this will be a breath of fresh air, an opportunity to grow your skills, get them transferable. If you wanted to leave aged care, you've got the skills. Is that sort of how they see it, or how is it for your teams that are actually in the aged care facility?
When we go into a new site and we onboard a team that have already been working in aged care for a while and we move them onto our system and do a couple of days training, you always get a little bit of resistance because you're assuming that if we're there, they're being told by their managers that they could do better. So there's always a little bit of resistance. But then by the end of 4 days, always, they are so on board because they get to cook. They get to cook with love and time rather than spending their time on admin and figuring out menus, writing menus and trying to get, recommended daily intakes for these people across a menu in a day. And then you get inconsistency from site to site when every shift manager has a responsibility on their own site to do it. And so by the end, we find that they're feeling quite like their core role has been rediverted into nourishment and feeding, nurturing. They have time to care. And then also what we do is we strip back a lot of the institutionalization. So like I said, I throw out the ice cream scoops that get used for dishing up mashed potato. But things, a lot of these kitchens are built with things like brat pans and tilting kettles. And nobody who doesn't work in the industry won't know what those things are. But they're hugely expensive, thousands and thousands of dollars worth of equipment that cooks slop in bulk. And that's kind of what goes on in all of the kitchens as well. So we take them back to using raw ingredients and stirring the pots, not opening packets. And we find that they really revel in that great home cooking.
Much more meaningful to take a potato and see it on the plate as nice, delicious, buttery mashed potato.
Yeah.
You've spoken a little bit about Michelle, your business partner. How do you guys work together? I'm guessing you bring different skills and experience to your companies. How do you work together and how do you sort of split your roles?
We joke a lot, and so do our staff, that we are two halves of a single person because we are so very different what we bring to the table. It's almost like one of us couldn't function that well without the other now. And the staff always joke about how we're like an old married couple because we fight, we disagree, we snap at each other, but we are each other's ride or die. So none of that really matters. And I do a lot of the menu and client work, and Michelle does a lot of the operational work. She is the patient one. She is level-headed, reasonable, rational, will take time to consider something. And I'm the reactive, much less considered, shoot from the hip person. So we definitely feel like we force each other to meet in the middle, and that works incredibly well. We work so well together. She is just one of the strongest women I've ever met in my life. And what we've been through together as well, it's a little bit like, you know, there's an old book called Emergency Sex and Desperate Other Measures, but how people in kind of really tough situations intensively bond with each other.
Trauma bonding.
Trauma bonding. And Michelle and I are so trauma bonded. We are so deeply trauma bonded.
Yeah. Has Michelle always been part of the business? How did the collaboration come about?
I love this, MJ. So years ago, many moons ago, when my father was recruiting for a new person to come into White Tie to assist him with his work, because he was doing all the operational stuff at that, all the financial and business management side of the business. And he recruited a role, and he had five candidates to interview, and Michelle was the first candidate. And Dad just fell head over heels in love with her and said, "That's the one." And I said, "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa. It's not a drop in center grant. We interview all candidates first. You know?" And he said, "I'm telling you now, we'll interview the other candidates, but I'm telling you now." And I should have known better than to ever question my father's ability to read somebody. So he employed Michelle. And then from that moment on, Michelle and I just started working so incredibly closely together, to a point where, what are we, 2022? So 2014, Michelle and I bought the business together. Yeah.
It must have been an interesting decision-making process.
Well, just to go back to the types of personalities that we are, we were at a meeting with the brokers at the time who said, "Have you ever thought about this?" And Michelle and I said, "Don't be ridiculous. That's my lost childhood in that company. You know, this is my teenage years of child slavery. I don't want a bar of it." And then Michelle said to me, "Oh, maybe we should think about it," as we got in the car to go back to the office. And by the time we'd got back to the office, I was saying to her, "Okay, well, what are we going to do? Ring Rob, ring your husband. I'll ring my husband, you ring your husband. Let's get this underway. Let's do it." She was like, "Whoa, whoa, let's just take a minute." But we were having the classic responses that we always do, where I'm, "Let's dive in, rip shit and bust." And she's more, "Let's actually take a step back and think about this and make a reasonable decision." So And then somehow in the middle, the decision was to buy.
How long was that process then?
It wasn't that long, because at the time my father was terminal and my parents still owned the business. And for me, it also seemed like a very good solution to get my parents out for them to enjoy some time before my father went. So we made that decision pretty quickly.
I suppose it was a bit of a non-entity as well.
I started working at White Tie when I was 15 years old. And then when I came back from the UK, I was 30, I think. And my parents had been invited by New Zealand to tender for the Christchurch Koru Lounge, and they kind of weren't really sure then how to run a tender. And I'd been working in the UK. And I said, well, I can stay and write a tender for you before I figure out where in New Zealand I want to go. And so wrote the tender and then ended up kind of never leaving. We got the Koru Lounges and stayed to run the business development side of the business for mum and dad at that stage.
How long did you guys manage the Koru Lounges for?
Until Chris Luxon arrived.
Oh, that's right.
I assume they don't give the like catering contracts out to anybody now.
No, I have some, I've never talked about this openly and publicly much before, but I'm happy to now. I harbour some real resentment about the way that was all handled by Air New Zealand. And at the time, and still now, we all view Air New Zealand as a national carrier bailed out by the taxpayer, but very parochial in its advertising and marketing, very much going after the we're Aotearoa, we're unique, we're interesting, we're different, we're fiercely loyal, we're fiercely local. And then Chris Luxon arrived and cut thousands of New Zealand suppliers out of the Air New Zealand network. And our contract went to a London-based caterer with a £16 billion annual turnover. And for me at the time, that just flew in the face of all of Air New Zealand's messaging to the public. And we were one of several thousand of small New Zealand businesses who were locked out of Air New Zealand by this real cookie cutter mentality. He wanted the experience in Invercargill to be the same as in LA, where previously you had quite a regional experience wherever you were in New Zealand with the lounges, which I still believe much more closely fitted with Air New Zealand's messaging.
Totally.
Holy shit.
That's wild.
I'm dark on it.
I was always so proud to be like, oh, that's our family friends company. Thank you very much.
Well, I think part of it was at the time that we were invited to do the tender for Air New Zealand, it was about making it more local. It was about, so we were awarded the contract from an international, like, so that prior to us going in, it was an international provider who ran the Christchurch lounges. So we did Christchurch and Wellington, but then you had an Auckland caterer do Auckland. And then you had local cafes doing Invercargill and Dunedin and Nelson. And it just fits much more with the type of corporate values that we thought we were working within New Zealand. We were probably quite naive in realizing that they were so interchangeable with the change of CEO.
Did you get any hint that it was coming, or did it come as a hell of a shock?
No, we didn't get a hint it was coming. We were treated quite poorly. And it was the same time as my father passing away. And I just remember thinking, this is the worst time of my life, because now I have to figure out how to keep White Tie afloat post-earthquakes. And so we were awarded the Koru Lounges in 2000. And Christchurch we took in 2008. And so then we were recovering from earthquakes, and we lost 7 of our 9 venues that we worked in at the time of the earthquakes, and we were an events company. And so we had so much already going on, and then we just felt so shafted from above, from a brand that we thought had our backs.
Yeah, it didn't seem like the Kiwi way.
It didn't. It didn't seem... I mean, like I said, it just didn't fit with their messaging at all. And 27 lounges went to an offshore provider and won contract award.
So do you fly Jetstar now?
I don't, because I'm too much of a loyalist. I don't fly Jetstar. I'm still proud of our national carrier for other reasons, just not. I don't know. Yeah, no, I'm Listen, I'm one of those people who's traveled around the world, and every time I've got on an Air New Zealand plane, wherever it is in the world, the sound of the welcome is just like already being at home.
Yeah.
And I, even though behind the scenes at that time, obviously the CEO's changed again since, but at that time I didn't feel like they were coming good on their messaging, but the messaging still is, it still affects you when you're a Kiwi, a traveling Kiwi, doesn't it?
Definitely. Definitely.
You think, oh yeah, I'm a sucker for that. I'm a sucker for that. Welcome to Air New Zealand when you're on the tarmac at Heathrow and someone says, welcome to Air New Zealand, and you say, oh, kia ora, I have missed you guys.
Or they play Dave Dobbin, Welcome Home, every time.
Hey, I worked in the press gallery when that came out, the whole Ahmed Zawi thing going on. And I just remember that was one of the things that I couldn't deal with. And Dave Dobbin did the song and it was like, well, that's all I want to say and I'm not allowed to say it.
Yeah, God. I was just going to say, do you ever miss the journalist life?
I miss the news because I still am a news soak. I still wake up and the first thing I do is read the news. I read the news all day. I have sisters who are very involved in policy in the world in various forms, and family members. And so the news is always just constantly in my mind and what's going on in the world. But I couldn't go back to being an impartial journalist.
Do you think there is a lot of impartiality in journalism these days? Has there been a bit of a shift?
I think it's really interesting because there's been so much tumult about it in New Zealand with COVID, where we've questioned whether or not we have an impartial media. And I just think New Zealanders are still not quite aware that they have a media that is world-class when it comes to independence. And I mean, we don't have a Rupert Murdoch broadsheet in this country. And that's a really big deal because I just watched I watched the front cover polls and all sorts of things going on in the lead up to the Australian election, thinking, you know, those newspapers aren't necessarily taking a position, but they're definitely leading a line. Whereas in the UK, for example, you come up to an election time, or not even an election time, you know the position that every newspaper takes. They take a position. They don't pretend to be impartial. They say who they are. Now, so that's quite a safe mechanism for, I know that I'm reading right content or left content or whatever. But all that does is people only then seek news from a news agency that agrees. So that's all that's doing is creating bias. Whereas in New Zealand, we still do have true independence in our media. We have stuff that's New Zealand owned. We have, you know, RNZ, which is New Zealand owned. We have Newsroom, which is New Zealand owned. We have so much independent media in this country, and I think that's something that we forget. We see what goes on in the rest of the world, but we don't have that kind of nefarious, manipulative media situation going on here. No matter how many protesters at Parliament would have told you that, that's just not the case.
Yeah. Yeah. What were you doing in the UK? How long were you there?
My husband and I travelled together for about not quite 2 years. Just do an OE, really, under 30, do the Working Holiday Makers. Cool. I ended up working at Saatchi & Saatchi, and that was kind of weird. That was quite a interesting experience.
What London
was very hard. I was working in project management in what they called human interests, which was their version of HR. So it was kind of like internal marketing in a way, but it was an interesting place to work, and they used to talk about the Kiwi Mafia all the time. And I don't know if any of you have come across that in your international travels, but where you find an organization that has a reasonable New Zealand contingent, and there is a bit of a, God, those guys go to the pub for lunch on a Friday, but then they go back to work and they make the rest of us look bad. I used to call them the Kiwi Mafia. Yeah, so we were just living in the UK for a couple of years. That was straight out of the press gallery at that time, and that was when I decided not to pursue journalism for a little while to see what I wanted to do.
How did that freedom from the press gallery feel?
Absolutely suffocating, because it had been so long since I didn't know what I wanted to do and who I was and what I stood for. And I went to London and ended up getting this job, and And there's a real, I don't want to stereotype too much, but there does seem, my experience of working in London, there was a real hierarchy of job titles. And we don't necessarily have that. And I'd also come from the press gallery, and I didn't change the way I spoke to anybody on the basis of their job title. And that didn't go down that great. So I got in a little bit of trouble reasonably early on for my tone, speaking to the head of account management. And I thought, why don't, that's my voice. I don't know about the tone thing. That's my voice. But I really struggled with the fact that I had been speaking to Helen Clark on a daily basis. So I didn't give a shit who the head of account management was or why I should change my behavior towards her. I really struggled with that. I really struggled with going to a place where there was just this 9 to 5, very clock in, clock out, hierarchical, gendered, over-processed working environment, and went, whoa, this is weird. This doesn't make any sense to me. I really struggled in it, and I thought, I've done the wrong thing. I've thrown away a career in journalism, and, you know, I've done the wrong thing. So I spent about 2 years panicking.
What made you, what got rid of that panic? Or did you come back and?
Drugs, Bridget, drugs.
Oh, thank God.
What are we talking?
Well, I'm glad we're on the same page.
Me and half of Christchurch, I tell you, I think if anyone came to Christchurch and said, let's do a stock take on the percentage of Cantabrians who are on anti-anxiety medication. I think what stopped that? Nothing particularly yet. I'll let you know when it stops. I think my problem is, to get into the nitty-gritty, my problem is that I have a social conscience that has determined most of my life experiences, and I'm 43 now and still not working full-time to honour that social conscience. And I think that's probably where I'll get to, and then I'll probably go, oh, now I've found myself. I'm 85 years old and I've found myself. Well done you, Katie.
What would tick the boxes for you? Where is that social compass pointing you, and you just can't quite get there because of all your commitments?
Because I spent time in the news and in the press gallery, I'm somewhat of a political animal, and I'm very engaged in what's happening here in New Zealand with our politics and what's happening socially. And I just want to feed the children, and the rest of it is noise.
Would you ever take a step into politics? Is this the start of a campaign?
No, I do get asked occasionally. And I think again, okay, I saw this great Cate Blanchett quote not long ago, where she was like, I'm 40, full of rage and not here for your shit. And I thought, oh my God, that's so how I feel. I'm over 40, full of rage and not here for your shit. So I don't know that that would go that well in the house.
It's hard too, because you've got all of these other commitments with all of your other companies. So figuring out how you would either change your career completely or weave
it in.
Yeah, weave it in.
Yeah, and I think doing it absolutely is harder, and I am motivated and inspired every single day by the extraordinary number of women in my family who give back to the world in various ways. And so I feel like my family's doing our part, which is great, but at some stage I will need to do something. I'm finding it increasingly difficult to be the intellectual disparity of living in New Zealand and people down the road from me not being able to feed their children, people down the road from me the other side building multi-million-dollar houses. The intellectual disparity of that, and the fact that that happened, we've got a population of 5 million. If we can't feed everybody and be visionary and interesting and brave enough to sort out an incredible quality of life for 5 million people, then we're all absolutely fucking stupid. I just am so angry about children in New Zealand with empty stomachs And it's like I said, we've got, It's like I said, we've got 5 million people in New Zealand. So the fact that any one of them is hungry is an absolute shame on us as a small, independent, agriculturally productive nation. It is our shame that we have such social disparity in this country now.
Do you think there are any organizations, not-for-profits, government agencies that are doing good in this space?
I do, Mary Jane, I do. I do think that there are so many agencies who are doing well in this space. But the most of the, if you look at social policy research, every single time the thing that works is giving people money. And we say, we over-intellectualize that part of it. We say, let's have this targeted program. Why don't we have budget literacy? Budget literacy is useless if you've got nothing to have literacy about, right? You've got this targeted program, this targeted program, this targeted program. But actually, by far the majority of research in this space shows that giving people money is the thing that solves problems. Universal basic income solve problems. And what we have instead is all of these targeted programs where we have, for example, a supermarket monopoly crisis in New Zealand where supermarket owners are making millions and millions and millions of dollars and their minimum wage workers are being propped up by working for families. And it's so stupid. Like it's just, it's nonsensical. Like it's a group of smart people. It's a group of smart people in a room who can't really see the very basic thing that's going wrong there. That we have an essential service like grocery pricing and people can't afford groceries and the people who own the supermarkets are making huge amounts of profit and that profit is unpaid wages because their minimum wage staff are only making ends meet if they are because of things like working for families.
Would you ever go down the route of, I instantly think of things like leading a campaign with the Commerce Commission, but then I also think of practical things that use your skills, like, you know, your Eat My Lunch. Would you ever go down the route of something practical that combines the white tie catering with this kind of social?
Yeah, any or all of those opportunities, and we have done We have done a lot. I mean, we started a few years ago, we started the White Tie City Mission Fund. We actually had, we engaged a couple of farmers who would actually provide us a certain number of animals. Then we'd get volunteers come in and we'd cook meals. It's, yes, except that, Bridget, this is a whole other piece of this, but hospitality is the one that is always asked to help out charities constantly. You know, I think about the number of times we've been asked for help. I've been asked to help fundraise money for private schools in the last year in Christchurch. And you think, come on, guys, I'm a hospitality business in the middle of COVID.
It speaks to the whole, the overarching major issue, which is a lot of people just care about number one and their family, which I understand, like it's especially in the current environment.
So I don't understand that.
I personally don't understand it. I understand it objectively.
I think for me, one of the most important things, and now being a 43-year-old mother of two, one of the most important things I've learned about being a human being is that I don't need to experience something to have empathy for someone else's experience of that. Yeah. A really good example of that, if I may, is Nick Smith's valedictory speech out of Parliament. He was a New Zealand MP for a very long, far too long time. And he did his valedictory speech and said that one of his greatest regrets as an MP was not voting for marriage equality. Because after he voted against marriage equality, his son then eventually came out to him. And people said, oh, wasn't it great that he could admit that? And I said, no, it wasn't great that he could admit that. It wasn't great that he could not have any empathy for that experience because it hadn't affected him personally. And I think that that's where I feel like there's a real dichotomy going on with society at the moment where it is genuinely between the people who think about my needs or think about our needs. And those are the real differences that we're facing as we continue to grow this social disparity. Sorry, I didn't mean for it to be a lecture.
eat my lunches and those types of social enterprises almost seem like the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff, whereas you're talking about much wider change, and it's changed to the way people think, perception, it's changed to our systems, our structures, our systemic inequalities and poverty. So part of me thinks, let's think bigger.
Yeah, let's
do the tough stuff.
It's like you and I being bullied to make changes for climate change. We're responsible for some minimum percent of it. Why are you having the conversation with us?
Mm.
Why aren't you having the conversation with all of the corporates that are creating all the, you know, why is it being put on us to change the climate when by far the majority comes from manufacturing and business and not the individual? And it's exactly the same for social needs in our society. Why are so many people being picked up by neighborhood social groups and not actual services that are there to provide? You know, we used to pride ourselves on being progressive in New Zealand. We prided ourselves on creating social services. We prided ourselves on being nuclear free, on being the first country in the world to give women the vote. We've completely lost our ability to be visionary and be brave and say, okay, let's give everybody a universal basic income for a year and see what happens, or everybody under a certain earning threshold and see what happens, because you will only see people responding to opportunity given to them. My father used to say, who was literally the greatest man to ever walk the face of the earth, hands down, won't hear a word against it. My father used to say that poverty is the single greatest thing wrong with the world, because it just strips people of choice. They have no choices. They have no opportunities. We know that our children that are raised in impoverished homes have a lesser ability to concentrate and learn when they're in primary school. Where does that cycle ever stop? Where do we actually do something visionary that affects those people's lives and stops that nonsense, basically? Just in a country of 5 million people, I keep coming back to that. It is so easy to turn this ship around. We're a dinghy on the world, you know? It's so easy to turn this ship around.
And it's not like we're poor. We're a wealthy country.
No, we're not even.
We don't have an excuse, really.
We don't even have national debt.
Yeah.
The same way as other, you know, as other normalized Western nations do.
Talking about Dad, you mentioned that him passing was one of the toughest times of your life. Can we talk a little bit about that and how you managed to steer your way through that?
You can see how that goes for you, Mary Jane. Let's see how it goes.
Don't have to. We don't have to talk about it. He's such a great man. These types of moments and events in people's lives really affect them. Getting through them is a challenge, and lots of people can learn from others' experiences, I guess. But you don't have to.
It's okay. Let's talk about it.
It was, how long ago did Grant pass?
Grant passed in 2016.
On March the...
February 28th. At 2 a.m., we were so worried he was going to die on the 29th, and for some reason that mattered at the time, that we couldn't celebrate his passing for 4 years in between. I don't know. For some reason that mattered, but he died at 2 a.m. on February the 28th. And he was a remarkable man, and I'm one of four girls, and so he had this house with his wife and his four girls, this house full of women, and he just worshipped the ground that we walked on. He was the most amazing feminist and all of our teacher, and we were so bereft without him for a time, even though he tried so hard to prepare us for his passing. He wanted to have conversations about it. He wanted us to be prepared and understand that he was okay and not scared, and all of that helped, but my greatest fear my whole life had been my father going. And so when he did and I realized my greatest fear, it was very intense time. Because he was my person. He was my mentor. He was my barometer. He was my moral compass. And our relationship was very spiritual. We talked very openly about our life experiences and what we were after, and then he wasn't there anymore.
Must have been so tough because he had quite a deep relationship with Michelle as well. Am I correct?
You are correct.
For the two of you navigating the company after him passing with that deep grief and everything else surrounding it. Did you have to lean on others to help you guys get through that period, or did you just muddle through together with the support of your family? Because your family is very involved in the business as well, right?
We're a close family. Yes. So my sister works for White Tie. We're a very close family. And that was the way that our parents raised us. So the impact of the influence of my family on my decision-making in my life and my emotional stability is really strong. My sisters can really bring me down and level me out. And that's really powerful. And I think for Michelle and I, it was probably more of a relief that she felt similar about him, that I wasn't that person who'd lost their father and went back to work. So she understood the impact of it, but she understood the genuine specialness and uniqueness of my father and how he managed to just bridge, he managed to bring people together. He managed to find common ground with everybody. He just ended up being everybody's kind of special person that they needed to talk to when they weren't okay. And it's so incredibly unconditionally loving and non-judgmental. And so I think that Michelle and I, it would have been very difficult, significantly more difficult for me to have had to go back to work without having a business partner who understood the kind of human being he was. And then for a long time, every time I pulled out a document at work that had a signature on it, I can do that now without crying, but
wow.
It's still,
everything would remind you, wouldn't it?
Oh, he's still there all the time. He's everywhere. Yeah.
White Tie Health Services started after...
After Dad.
After Dad. Yep. Is that something you'd spoken to him about, your passions? Is that something that you were happy to see realised? Or was that the first thing you'd done without his input?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was. It was quite full on because his mother, my grandmother, had been in dementia care, and that was really tough. And my nana, my mother's mother, had been in aged care. And we often talked about, God, look at that food. We could do so much better, and it's just terrible. And I remember my mother saying to me, oh, sometimes I've walked out of there and thought you should be walking out of there and leaving your mother to eat that. So it was kind of already, because we were, because at the time the family business was involved in food, it was something that we talked about a lot. Dad would be very proud. Dad would be incredibly proud that our doors are still open today after the last 6 years since he passed. He'd be incredibly proud that we've managed to navigate the business to still be open after everything that we've been through.
But yeah. There are some long days where you think the same. I'm really proud of myself to still be here.
My business partner and I, we decided we'd take ourselves away earlier this week, director's retreat, we called it, because we quite liked the ring of it. We just went away for a couple of days to do some work and do some strategy on how does scaling back up after COVID look like for the next 12 months. We high-fived ourselves and went, okay, we've got this. High five. We're brilliant. We're good. Okay. We got it. High five.
Well, we kind of have to celebrate these things, yeah. Especially you guys have been just in crisis management since the earthquakes. It's been one thing after another. It's really important to take a step back and go, yes, we are amazing. We've learned from this and let's move forward. But it is important to celebrate survival.
Survival is an important thing to celebrate. We had this really fabulous sales manager who used to work for us, and she used to say, good job, self, and then literally give herself a little pat on the shoulder.
I like that.
I really loved it. She's such a ray of sunshine, and she would, 2 o'clock in the morning at an event when everybody's exhausted, she'd say, right, we're all going to stop and we're going to shake it off. And then she'd say, hey, and now give yourself a good job, self, and a little pat. But I always loved it because she was so always prepared to give herself props when she'd done a great job. And I just thought, you know, because I'm a parent and we tell our children to love themselves, but then when people tell you they love themselves, we think, ooh, aren't they arrogant? Where's the humility? Yeah. We give such conflicting messages. Love yourself. Mm. Okay, yes. Ooh, aren't you arrogant? Like, which way do you want me to go here? Mixed messaging. So I think learning to give yourself a pat on the back is really important.
Well, half the time, no one else is going to do it for you, especially in New Zealand. Like, we're just not very good at doling it out. Some people are, but in general, we're just not really good at it.
No, and I remember my father used to say, blow your own trumpet, Kate, because no one else will.
Exactly. Quite uncomfortable to start with, but I mean, I think you can get
used to it.
It's like everything else. Practice makes comfortable.
I've just learned in so many ways as a woman, I've just learned to lean in. So I'm really comfortable leaning into my self-worth these days.
I mean, you've worked at it.
Yeah. No, I have worked at it. It hasn't come naturally. You're quite right.
Speaking of your babies, they're not babies now, your children. You're a mum of two kids.
Yeah.
And that happened in the last decade, I suppose. So you've
and amongst all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How did that impact your life, challenge the way you perceived your career, but even yourself as a person?
I never knew that I was going to have children. I thought that I might, but it was never an absolute for me. I probably could have gone either way. And then I had children, and now I don't know why I don't have all the children and why I can't care for all the children and feed all the children. And it's not the same for everybody, and nor should it be. And I don't mean my experience to apply any pressure, but having children for me was such an exercise in understanding love and unconditional love. I remember someone saying to me once that having a child is like having your heart walking around outside your body, and that's exactly what it's like. I was also a terrible pregnant woman, and I had hyperemesis for both the full 9 months of both of my children, and then I wasn't able to breastfeed at all, or as they like to call it, primary insufficiency, which I raged against. I said I was not as efficient in any area.
What the fuck?
But it's officially what they call it, primary insufficiency. I have since spoken to a breastfeeding hui to tell them that is a no bueno. I was not able to breastfeed either of my children, which I thought was the end of the world, and put myself through all of the ringers that women do of breast is best, and I've failed them, and pumping 12 times a day to get 50 mils and not sleeping and just making it so much worse because of societal norms around what I needed to do and what my behavior should have been. And it's just so exhausting all the time to buy into that. And now I feel that I've become quite insufferable because I actively rage against those norms that are applied to us. Sometimes I probably don't even give it thought as to whether or not I agree with it or not. I just think, no, you don't get to make assumptions of us anymore. Mm. And that's what I will teach my children.
Amazing. Role models. You come from a long line of very accomplished people, both sides of the family.
I come from a long line of terrifying women. My mother is one of four girls and two brothers, but the women in that family have really carved and forged their own ways. And I have three sisters, and the experience of feeling so incredibly formidable when we're all four of us together, like I just feel invincible. My sisters make me feel invincible. And then I've just had the incredible benefit of very special people in my life and very special role models with a very dear family friend who was in aid work overseas for 40 years. And for me, growing up and then becoming a journalist, to have this woman who dedicated her entire career to bettering the lives of vulnerable people was an extraordinary example of selflessness and empathy and compassion. And she was also incredibly intelligent and somewhat intimidating. So the example that she gave us was that it was never for her own benefit. She didn't do it because it made her feel good. She did it because she knew how to improve people's lives. So that was a really incredible role model. And then, you know, in business and in journalism, varying kind of role models at different times that really inspired me to be, I'm very attracted to slightly fringe personalities, slightly rebellious personalities as role models.
Mm-hmm.
I've always worried if I didn't want to be anything, I wouldn't want to be boring.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you've achieved that.
I always find, you know, you meet those people who really march to the beat of their own drum, and I just get so much joy from those people. So much joy from those people who are just a kind of a little bit different.
Yeah. Mm. I love them too. I wish I had sometimes a bit more of their courage. I'm a bit of a people pleaser, I think. I always wish I just didn't care so much.
Yeah, I think I used to do that much more than I do now, and now I care less and less. And I remember seeing someone recently, and you know, it was probably, I think it was a client, and you know, you obviously watching your behavior in front of a client, you're being very careful and moderate, and you know, and there was a comment that was made. There had been some conversation around social disparity because he'd been at Ngāi Tahu for a very long time here in Christchurch, and he said, "Why are you so angry?" And I said, "Why aren't you more angry?" You know, whereas a few years ago, I probably would have gone, "Oh God, did I come across angry?
Yeah.
Am I being challenging? Have I got too much to say? Am I being too opinionated?" And I said, "Why aren't you more angry? You've got people down the bloody road who can't feed their children. Why doesn't that make you furious?"
How did he respond?
He just kind of laughed at me.
Do you know what I'd love to know how to do it, because I think one of the most beautiful things about getting older is you do give less fucks, but you just learn so much more. I just wish I could give like my 16-year-old self the agency to speak, the room to be myself. So much fucking wasted time being careful or considered.
Doesn't that make you feel heartbroken? Because I had that conversation with someone today, because I had dinner tonight with my old news director, and a girlfriend of mine said today, you know, what was it like being in the press gallery and all those kind of things? And I said, if I was a baby, and if I knew then, like I know now, my right to speak and be heard in any room that I am in, I would have had such a different experience, and I would have been quite a different journalist. And I hope more than anything that that's the experience that I give to my children, that they don't always question their worth or their ability to speak up and say something in any environment. Like, I want them to question authority, just not mine, right? But I totally hear what you, I know exactly what you mean, Bridget, because it took us so long to, and much more so as women, to figure out that we were allowed to speak. I often have this, so a lot of my staff, a lot of my event staff are university staff. And I was driving, and not that long ago, driving to a van load of staff to an event in North Canterbury. And these girls started talking about how university is so hard, and they go into the room and they feel so stupid, and they look around and none of the others look like they feel stupid. And, you know, the guys make it seem so easy, and they speak up without giving it a second thought. And obviously I'm not as intelligent. And I just said, "Oh my God, you're 18 years old and you've got imposter syndrome." Mm. And I need you to be the generation that doesn't do that. I need you to understand that those boys go into that lecture theatre and think that there is space for them to speak, because there has always been space for them to think. And it's not because they have anything better to say. It's because there's always been a seat at the table for them. And that's not to take away what they have to say. They, yes, keep the seat at the table, let them say what they have to say, but add your seat there too, and have what, you know, I had this whole conversation with a van load of 18-year-olds going, "Please, please don't be another generation of imposter syndrome." I'm going to tell you the smallest thing that happens to me all the time, and oh my God, it pisses me off, and it happens to me all the time. So I work in events, and a lot of our events we do are in marquees. There's a lot of logistics involved, there's travel involved, all those kind of things. Now, every other weekend I take a trailer to an event and I reverse the trailer right to where I need the trailer to go. And every other time a man knocks on the window and says, would you like me to do that for you?
So annoying.
I can't tell you how much it drives me insane.
So true.
My dad taught me a couple, like years ago, how to back a trailer. And it was one of his most proud. It's just one of those things that he just gets so much pride out of. I have to, every single time we're at a boat ramp, he will not do it. I have to swap into the driver's seat and he will not let me get out of it. He's like, nah, you deserve to be on that ramp. Take as long as you want. We're going to pick the hardest one to go down.
It's exactly what my father was like. I actually recently was at an event where the client was reversing a trailer and I said, would you like me to do that for you? And he went, what? No. He just screwed up his face and went, no. And I said, I've just always wanted to say it. That's all.
Bet that would have felt so good.
Do you need a hand beer?
Honestly, if someone said that to me, I'd be like, yes, thank you very much. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
But that's okay.
Yeah, exactly.
We want, Mary Jane, what we actually want is if you have to reverse a chiller trailer and you can't do it, we want you to ask for help.
Oh, no, I know.
I can't do this. Can you give me a hand?
Yeah.
I can't do this, not because I'm a woman, because I haven't learnt.
Yeah.
Because I haven't been shown before.
And I have zero desire for it too.
I don't understand
why. It's quite
fun,
Mary. It's definitely... goals. It's intellectual
very handy. Activity.
When you reverse a chiller trailer right into position, lined up, like you just go, oh, I'm good
amazing.
At this
shit. Yeah. No, I appreciate it for sure.
At me world, I can reverse a trailer.
Yeah, you feel fucking successful, eh?
I've just put myself in situations where when I've hired a trailer, I only have to go forward.
Well, you take it off, turn it around.
We have a very good girlfriend who's the same. She's like, I've got to go and do this thing and I've got to get mum's horse float, but I think I'm going to need to reverse a bit. So are you free to come with?
We've been on the phone with you for a long time now. We should probably let you go.
Your babies will be asleep.
Babies won't be asleep. But anyway, I think our takeaway is that I'm over 40 and full of rage and not here for your shit.
And that brings us to the end of today's episode. Thank you so much for listening. We got a bit carried away with chatting and didn't properly take the time to thank Katie for joining us today. So Katie, thank you again for your time and your candor. We really appreciate it. If you're interested in learning more about White Tie Catering and the catering department, I have popped links to their websites and Instagram accounts in the show notes below. And do you or someone you know have a career story to share? If so, please get in touch. All of the ways you can contact us are also in the show notes. If you are so inclined, please rate and review the Super Good Juice podcast. It is amazing to hear your feedback and it also helps others to find us. Super Good Juice is a Pop A Pod On production. This episode was produced by Bridget Ashby and me, Mary Jane Rewa. Editing and sound design is also by me. The music you hear in this podcast is sourced through upbeat.io. The artist is Tatami, and the track is called In Motion. See you next time.